From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm producer Megan Mack.
And I'm Evan Dawson. Let's start this podcast with the kind of thing that talk show hosts are not supposed to say. You're about to hear my favorite all-time guest on Connections.
Evan's talking about Adam Frank, an astrophysicist at the University of Rochester and the creator of NPR's 13.7 Cosmos and Culture blog. Adam has just co-authored a paper that attempts to do something that seems almost impossible.
Yeah, he created an equation to determine how likely it is that there has ever been intelligent technological life elsewhere in the universe. In other words, what are the mathematical odds that human beings are unique and alone? This clip is a little longer than most, but trust me, Adam is the kind of person you wish you had teaching your science classes growing up. And his work kind of blew my mind here. He took the famous 1961 equation known as the Drake equation that marked the first time someone tried to quantify the odds that we're not alone in the universe, or maybe we are. Here's Adam telling us how the new equation shows we are probably not alone.
Over the past 50 years, we have discovered, we've now actually nailed all the terms in the Drake equation that have to do with just astronomy. Those are the first three terms. The rate of star formation, how many stars form per year, the fraction of those stars that have planets, and then the number of planets around any of those systems that have planets that are in the right place, what we call the habitable zone, where basically we think the temperature is just right for life to form. So all of those terms are now, I mean, it's just mind-blowing. We now know those numbers. And even, you know, 20 years ago, we didn't know those numbers. So that is a revolution in astronomy. That's a revolution in human understanding. And what I wanted to do with my collaborator, Woody Sullivan, is figure out, well, how do we, you know, what can we do with this? How can we, you know, use this new data to say something that couldn't have been said before? And what we figured out was the question you have to ask that you can answer is, how many civilizations have ever existed? Or at least put limits on, you know, probability. We can talk about probabilities. What can we do with, we can somehow constrain the probabilities for how many civilizations have ever existed. They may all be gone by now, but, you know, that was the question. And if I could just say, when we talk about, when we ask, are we alone? There's two ways to ask that. Are we alone now? Or are we alone in the sense that we're the first time and the only time in the whole history of the universe that sentience, that intelligence has ever evolved? And to me, actually, they're equally interesting.
So I would say, are we alone or are we unique?
Right? Yeah, that's right. That's a nice way of putting it.
Okay. So what did you have to do here? You know, what did you have to do to create these new parameters?
You know, so here's the other three terms in the Drake equation. There is the probability that a given planet has life forming on it, the probability that that planet that has life, evolves up to intelligence, and then the probability that that intelligence goes on to create a technological civilization. So all three of those terms, either one, any of those, we have no idea what they are. We just have no idea. There's some science that can kind of guide speculation, but basically we're clueless. So we combine them all into one, and we call it the biotechnical probability. That's the probability that you take a habitable zone planet, a planet that's in the right place for life, and it goes all the way up to forming a civilization. And so then we said, okay, I want to know what's the limits on that probability such that we're the only time it's ever happened, right? So that the number of civilizations that are formed is one, right? Us. So what we're basically doing, we call this the pessimism line, right? If you're pessimistic about life in the universe, you can't get more pessimistic than saying we're the only one that's happened. So what this number, this biotechnical probability limit gives
get
us...
Get ready for this number.
Yeah,
this is crazy.
It tells you how bad the odds would have to be in order for us to be the only time it's happened. And it turns out to be 1 in 10 billion trillion. Right? 1 in 10 billion trillion.
How many zeros is that?
That is 10 to the minus 22, right? 0.22 zeros and then a one, right? So here's a way to think about it. Here's a good way to think about it. In order for us to be the only civilization, only time in the entire history of the universe that life has formed and gone on to intelligence, it's like, imagine I gave you a bag of planets, right? A bag of planets, and these are not just any kind of planets, not like Mercury, which is like right up against the sun. These are all planets that are like Earth or in the right place.
Goldilocks zone planets.
Goldilocks zone planets. What we're saying is, in order for us to be the only time this has ever happened, you'd have to go through 10 billion trillion planets, like, you know, picking them out of the bag. Nope, before you got to us, right? And so it's so that number is so small, or that, you know, that probability is so crazy that of course it's happened before. Like, even if you were pessimistic, nobody's that pessimistic.
Well, some.
You know, when you look at the astronomy literature, this is what's interesting. So, you know, there's people have been arguing about the Drake equation for a long time. And in general, when someone's pessimistic, they'll say like, oh, you know, the odds are one in a billion. Even like really,
one in a trillion.
Yeah, really pessimistic. Like someone who's really, really pessimistic would say one in a trillion. Well, if you are that pessimistic, it means it's happened 10 billion times.
Let me just add part of my own interpretation of this, because having gotten to know Adam, you know, again, so much of Adam's work in recent years has been looking at climate, which is interesting for an astrophysicist, but Adam is someone who is very much concerned with where the future of this planet is going from an astrobiological perspective. And so this equation doesn't prove that we are not alone or that that we are not unique. But what it shows you is it seems very unlikely, unless you're a big pessimist, as
right.
Adam said.
You have to be a hyper-pessimist.
You got to be a hyper-pessimist. And if you then say, well, then we're likely not unique and we're not alone, even if we never prove it, we can have some solidarity with the fact that there is a graveyard of civilizations out there in the universe and we are heading in that direction unless we make some good decisions.
Yeah.
And there is value in feeling that solidarity that says we're not the only ones who've gone through feedback loops and increasing in population and energy and what happens to a planet's atmosphere when you consume more. And we've got to make some good decisions if we don't want to just join the rest. That's how I view your work.
Right. We don't want to end up on the cosmic loser list. We're trying to frame what is going on right now with climate change and sustainability in an astrobiological perspective. It was actually out of that this we figured out we stumbled on this result. And what we're truly saying there is, you know, we're not the only time that this has happened. What we wanted to show was that it's a reasonable argument to say that many species have gone through what we're going through now.
Let's turn now to a conversation that might not seem related, but it is. Adam Frank says that if we're going to grapple with climate change, we have to do a better job of dealing with poverty. Because if you're living in poverty, your focus is not on environmental sustainability, it's on getting by day to day.
We welcome the director of the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative. The group has recently published their first extended explanation of how they plan to approach poverty in our region. This is Dr. Leonard Brock.
People in poverty are not lazy. And then you cannot generalize and say that everyone in poverty doesn't want to work or doesn't want to go to school or they're not motivated or they don't demonstrate personal responsibility. Because ironically, when you look at the data, and Henry can actually speak to this, within the catchment neighborhood, we have 23,000 people within the three neighborhoods that we're targeting. Market View is not necessarily part of Connected Communities, but it's part of the anti-poverty catchment neighborhoods. So you have 23,000 people, you have 1,000 persons with post-secondary credentials. So not only do you have persons with post-secondary credentials, there's this other term that we use quite frequently in the community called working poor. These are individuals that are going to work and still living below the poverty threshold. So if you have, and then when you looked at that, we did a demographic profile at the beginning of the initiative. And what we were able to find is that, you know, half, and again, there's ways that we have to still be able to dissect that data or disaggregate, half the working poor, as we classify as working part-time, full-time, or part-year, didn't have children. 25% had a post-secondary credential, and this is the working poor, which means they're working. So what are we doing as it relates to the 25% of the quote unquote working poor that is doing everything that we said you need to do to get out of poverty by having a job, getting an education that doesn't necessarily serve true. So there's 1,000 persons in the catchment neighborhood specifically, and we know that those are graduates, and there are 430 plus like MCC students that are currently in school in that neighborhood. So we have to think differently. We have to lead with the numbers. We have to lead with the data.
Connected to poverty, sadly, is the heroin epidemic that has exploded in Western New York. Now, heroin is not a problem only for people who are poor. In fact, it's in the suburbs, it's in rural areas, it's everywhere. It does not discriminate, but it is undoubtedly destroying lives.
We talked to Donna Rose, the mother of a young man addicted to heroin. Here she is talking about the frustration of dealing with insurance companies, which happens to be a big issue for many families who don't understand why their claims are denied.
At the bottom of the booklet that tells you about the plan's benefits, there's a caveat, a tiny little print says, all benefits are subject to medical necessity. I called our insurance company many times and said, would you send me a list of what constitutes medical necessity so that we can somehow gather together everything the insurance company requires? I was promised at least three times, oh yes, we'll send that to you, oh yes. Never received it. I didn't know at that time. That's motivation. your mom and dad love you, you have a place to live. I was hearing from people that you could get your loved one into treatment if you were willing to make that person homeless and stop your insurance right away and slide them into Medicaid.
That's why you decided to make your son homeless, to give him a chance?
I didn't. We did not. We did there. Our son is 20. His drug use began when he was probably 12 or 13. Started out with pot, moved into a little alcohol, then, of course, the oxys, which we now know was OxyContin, which is a chemically modified form of morphine. All pain medications are narcotic. All pain medications are modified, chemically altered forms of morphine. When they hit the brain, it's no different than the young person on the street seeking heroin bags, only the medications are far more expensive. Heroin's cheap.
And I'm sorry, what I heard you say earlier was that you had your son jailed, right?
Last February, yes, because we knew the next heroin, whether it be snorted or shot, injected, might be the last one, because most of the heroin coming from Buffalo and Rochester is laced with fentanyl. Fentanyl is the highest potency form, the modified form. It's what they use in surgery, and you instantly are out and you wake up in an hour. The dealers know that if they lace heroin with fentanyl, that it has a higher high, a faster high, but it's a deadly high. No suffering addict is capable of making the decision to save their own lives without treatment.
And you were told, essentially, you could get covered, but because you've created such a loving environment?
No, that's not it at all. Yes. What they're doing
the
is...
The motivation thing.
Well, would you say to someone who needs dialysis, your mom and dad love you, you're not homeless, you haven't, I don't even know what that, no disruption in your relationships means, so we're denying you dialysis.
So if things were worse for you, we would maybe get you some help, but things are pretty good for you. You've got a loving family, a loving environment.
Our insurance company has paid for, at least three ambulance rides, one suicidal evaluation at a hospital where they said, well, he's medically stable, he's lucid, intelligent, take him home. Our insurance company paid for emergency room visits where we were trying to get our son into detox, but we were told he's a low-level heroin user. He's only using 5 bags a day. We got 20 people coming in here using 20. We take them. Here's 4 medicines. Take him home. Detox him yourself. I bet you can imagine how well that went. So this little caveat, all benefits are subject to medical necessity, is the way insurance companies deny you what they promise you when you buy their plans. And never once has our insurance company sent back to us one premium.
This coming Tuesday, there's a town hall meeting to address insurance coverage for families dealing with addiction. It's at 6:30 Tuesday night at Genesee Community College.
Let's close the week with a look at an issue that seems to spark passions on all sides, bicycling.
Yeah, the city of Buffalo just announced a plan to add 200 more miles of bike lanes over the next 10 years. Your move, Rochester. Well, the city, our city, has added what it calls bike boulevards. Those are streets with reduced speed limits, bike lanes, sharrows, more signage, and there will be more. By the way, in this clip, I learned a new vocabulary term. You're about to hear from Dr. Scott McCray, president of the Rochester Cycling Alliance, and John Lamb from Reconnect Rochester, who's making the point here that simply adding bike lanes is not enough to be a bike-friendly city.
I don't even use bike lanes sometimes. I'll just take the lane if I don't feel that the bike lane is necessarily safe. I know that Main Street is up for redesign, and they're planning on putting in an extra, 58 parking spaces, and they'll be, if they're successful, highly used, and that means drivers will be opening their doors, and I probably will not be in the bike lane because I don't want to get doored.
Is that a verb that I've never heard of? is that a verb?
Oh, everybody in bicycle world knows doored.
Have you been doored before?
I have not. I've come close.
Anybody on this panel been doored before? No?
People want to ride to the right on a bike lane, but it really probably is safer to ride on the left side because of that. If you're on the left side of that bike lane, you're much less likely to get doored and surprised by a car. As long as you ride straight and are predictable, you should be pretty safe in that bike lane. Let me just point out, and I'm going to add to, I'm interested in public health as well, and getting people back into exercise the tremendous public health potential. I've been working with the CDC and some of the members of the CDC after a recent National Bike Summit. Basically, we're looking at the health benefits versus the safety risks. And the health benefits outweigh the safety risks anywhere from 5-1 in San Francisco to 77-1 in Barcelona, Spain, where the infrastructure is very, very bike friendly. But my point is, you're safer on your bike seat than you are on the couch because of the all the health problems of immobility, not moving around, the diabetes, weight problems. In Holland now, the childhood obesity rates are 5 times lower than the United States because these kids, when they're young, they're either biking or walking to school. And there's just tremendous potential for us to get our communities out. And we are in a competition. We are, Sam
Schwartz. You view it that way?
Yeah, we are in a competition, and the mayors of cities all around the country, now I do a lot of national sort of overviewing, and the mayor of Indianapolis, who's a Republican, the mayor of Oklahoma City, who's a Republican, they both are very much into building biking, walking infrastructure because they realize that their downtown area, in the outlying areas, those areas are much more competitive for drawing in the best and the brightest, the young creative class, the millennials. They want communities where there's good biking, walking, and transit.
That does it for this edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and Finger Lakes Public Radio, WEOS 89.5 FM.
You can always find us on the WXXI mobile app as well. I'm Evan Dawson.
I'm Megan Mack. Have a wonderful weekend, and we'll talk with you Monday.